Good morning. Somebody once said that praise is like perfume. It's all right to sniff it, but don't swallow. So after that august introduction, I'm not quite sure I'm going to live up to that. It's a real pleasure to be back here with you on this particular day. This is, I can't tell you how much it fills my heart to be with you here now. I don't think those of us who were back in those early days thought we'd make it this far. You know, it's like, I'm still around. Okay, so I was asked to, there's going to be a variety of presentations over the next few days. The one that that we're starting off with today has to do with the nature of remembrance. There are clinical tests, research that's been conducted into the nature of memory. And we'll talk a little bit about that. I was also asked to talk about the incorporation of ISKCON. After all, this is the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the incorporation of Srila Prabhupada Society. And so there's a lot to do in just a little bit of time. Let me see if I can fill in just quickly on some of those rather pseudo-impressive credentials that you just heard. I turned 66 a few weeks ago, and as Prabhupada used to say, don't think this isn't going to happen to you. I didn't think it was going to be a big deal entering the 60s, but it is in a certain way. You look back and you see your life in different stages. And I remember specifically being here as a young lad, and the difference in emotions between then and now is quite pronounced. I'm married, I have two children. My son is an initiated disciple of His Holiness Radhanath Swami. His name is Namamrita. He lives with his family in the Alachua, Florida community. He's a pilot for Southwest Airlines. I have a daughter who's entering her PhD program in philosophy. I have no idea where she got that idea from. These days, my time is divided between lecturing and writing books and doing some documentary films. Somehow, my career after leaving 13 years in temples led me to study the Holocaust period. In Holocaust studies, we address some of the most existential questions in human history. How were human beings capable of reaching a point of acting so abominably toward others? Why some people survived and others did not? What is it about human nature that we learn from the Holocaust period? Are we slaves to that inferior nature? Can we rise above that kind of aggressive, hurtful demeanor? Never again has become ever again. The genocides continue around the world. And the nature of memory is a big topic in Holocaust studies as well. And there are some very interesting parallels between study of that very dark period in history and our position in Krishna consciousness. Let me give you an example. The research into survivor testimony, witness testimony, has to do with the return of traumatic memory. People who have come out of very difficult circumstances, the mind has an incredible ability to suppress hurtful memories. the mind's job is to protect the entity from harm. So sometimes that means setting aside, putting into deep storage memory of experiences that are hurtful. In a sense, we're also about the return of memory in Krishna consciousness, the memory of ourselves as eternal souls. And the trauma, if you will, that suppressed that memory for us was entrance into the material world. So there are some parallels to be drawn. Another parallel to be drawn is that what we remember is in large measure a function of what our life has been since the event we are trying to remember. Memory is not, we were discussing yesterday, memory is not like a book on a shelf in a library that you pull down, and every time you look at it, it's the same information. An event occurs, and we're speaking specifically of Srila Prabhupada coming to the West now. An event occurs, and as soon as that event is embedded in the mind, it begins to transform, because we are in a state of constant change. Memory is an interaction of biochemistry in the brain. It's stored in the relationship between neurons and particles. And the more our life goes through changes, the more the nature of what we remember also changes. So that you can have people remembering the same experience with Srila Prabhupada, and they'll remember it in completely different ways. Because what we are remembering is filtered through the lens of who we are and our experiences in life. So in that sense, we have a very great responsibility to be self-aware in how we perpetuate Srila Prabhupada's mission. We can perpetuate Srila Prabhupada's mission with any number of agendas, because we will remember a particular aspect of Srila Prabhupada. How many times do we hear Prabhupada said, only to hear in the next moment Prabhupada said something else that totally contradicted that? So to be self-aware in how we present Prabhupada's teachings is critically important. And it means my experience of the Bhagavad Gita has been that the Gita is a perfect study in human psychology. And the more we become aware of ourselves and the influences that have brought us to be who we are today, the more clarity we bring to our careers in Krishna consciousness. It's critically important that we understand this, that we can remember Srila Prabhupada with the purpose of perpetuating a very orthodox view of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. That there was a particular tradition that he represented. And some of that will be the byproduct of our own experiences in childhood. For example, if as a young person you had, let's say, parents who were very authoritarian, disciplinarian, well, you have a particular relationship with authority. And maybe that is coloring the way you remember Srila Prabhupada and the way you interpret his teachings. If we look at Srila Prabhupada's childhood, we see someone who was adored by his parents, spoiled silly, who had every encouragement to go the extra distance, exercise your God-given skills, be daring. The opening page of the biography of Srila Prabhupada that I was very privileged to write is a story that I got from Harisori Prabhu when Srila Prabhupada was a teenager. I wanted to get a sense of what was his character like before he met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And I asked Harisori, can you remember a story that Prabhupada told about himself as a young man? And he thought, and he said, yes, there's one incident in the 1914, approximately 12, somewhere in there, when Prabhupada was in his teen years. that the Victoria Memorial was still under construction then, and Prabhupada snuck under the construction barriers at night and climbed to the top of the construction and looked out on the horizon. And that gave me a wonderful opening to this biography of Srila Prabhupada, because you get a sense of him as someone willing to take risks, someone who had an interest in that far vision of things, wanting to see things from a higher perspective. So there are many different ways that we can approach our remembrance of Srila Prabhupada. And as I was thinking about notes for this class this morning, where do you begin? You know, this kaleidoscope, this universe of experiences and stories about Srila Prabhupada, and it was very difficult to figure out where to begin. But since I was asked to talk about the incorporation, I figured, let me start there. We come from a very elevated tradition. We have been invited into, as representatives of a very august, ancient tradition. It's a tradition that describes creation as one of infinite universes, oceans of milk and ghee, planets where the palaces are made of rare gems, inhabited by four-armed beings. It's a tradition of men, women, children, animals, thousand-hooded snakes, and giant boars and tortoises. A tradition that holds that the Supreme Being is a little blue-skinned boy who plays a flute and dances in the forest, lifts a hill with his little hand, little finger of his left hand. And where does he live, the Supreme Being? He lives in the smallest of the small and the greatest of the great. Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam. He lives in the atoms and between the atoms. And yet he is so grand, so magisterial, that from the pores of his body, universes emanate. So, it's an extraordinary vision of creation that defies everything we've heard from childhood. It is completely illogical from a material point of view. I remember in August of 1973, Srila Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasan, and I'm wondering to myself, what is he going to say now? Because everything was so mind-blowing. And once again, he did not disappoint. The first sentence of that class here in this room was, "So there is another universe." So here we go again. You know, and he was off describing the extraordinary spiritual world and this place beyond birth and death. So he was one who defied our puny intellect. Look at the image of Srila Prabhupada on that poster. What an expression, huh? Of utter defiance. Of course, it's an interesting photo to have chosen to illustrate the theme of joy of devotion, but but there we are. Yeah. Yeah. But he introduced us into a universe that defied all scientific logic and reason, that defied any commonsensical interpretation of what we see around us. So by incorporating ISKCON as he did, the incorporation of ISKCON was something more than just a legal measure. It was an act of defiance against the atheistic and mechanistic worldview. What he was saying was, get ready, because Krishna consciousness is here to stay, and this will challenge everything about your life. That incorporation was more than just a gesture of a non-profit entity that can now, you know, hold classes and conduct services and receive donations or whatever. It was a stake in the ground that your world is about to be turned upside down. And it's taken us a while to understand quite how profound that act of bringing Krishna consciousness to the Western world was. And what I, to this day, what I can't understand is how Prabhupada got on that boat. I promise you, it frightens me. At the age of 70, not knowing anyone here, not having any contacts, no money, no influence, no guarantee, no contract, you know, come and we will provide X, Y, and Z. To get on that boat, imagine the depth of his faith to be able to take such a risk, such a chance. And then along the way, two heart attacks, arriving in one of the coldest winters in U.S. history. The winter that year was so, of 1965, was so cold, snowdrifts were stacked up 6 feet tall along the sides of buildings. You know, boilers cracked. It was so cold. And Prabhupada had on these little flimsy white rubber shoes. And he had a coat, I think, that the Agarwals gave him. They gave him a coat and a sweater, so he had a little bit of something to wear. But yet he always spoke about how, well, we have temples around the world. Remember what it was he incorporated, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He had that vision. Even there's a professor who wrote a book. He went to Vrindavan and spoke with some of the Brijbasis there. And they said, yes, we remember Swamiji when he was here in the early 60s. He always talked about how there are temples around the world. And we're thinking, what is this foolish person? He's already here in Vrindavan. What is he agitating his brain about going to the West? He's already home. Why bother with all of that? And of course, now everyone claims, oh yes, we knew him. We were encouraging him in his mission. You know, we were his best friend back then. And then when he came to New York, he spoke the same way. That cold winter, he sat down on a bench in the park, and a postman came and sat down next to him. The postman was looking at how insufficiently Prabhupada was dressed against the cold, and said to him, I'm a postman, what's your situation? Prabhupada said, we're here. And says, you're on your own? And Prabhupada held up his beads and says, we're never alone. And then he shook the man's hand and went off to see if any of his books had sold in the bookstores. Difficult, difficult time. And yet he never lost faith. And that's, I guess, the part. Writing the book, people always ask me, what was the hardest part of writing this biography of Srila Prabhupada? Or the most surprising thing about... The most surprising thing was I didn't realize the depth of the sacrifice that Prabhupada made. I didn't understand it. I mean, we know it. You know, we talk about it. But to get a sense of how the rejection that he went through, the dire poverty that he endured, the disgrace, you know, the people, calumny that people were heaping upon him. His own family had such difficulty. I got to interview his son, Vrindavan Chandra Day, and Vrindavan Chandra said, look, say what you want, but he was our father. He was my father, you know. Because the question everyone always asked Vrindavan Chandra is, what was it like being there on the dock when Prabhupada boarded the Jaladuta to come to the West? And he said, well, what can you say? Psychologically, he said, he accomplished many wonderful things, and I was very proud of him for taking up his spiritual master's mission. But I cried. He's my father. Look. You know, he's going away to a very uncertain future. So the conclusion of the biography was when Prabhupada wins the court case. That was the trajectory. You know, as a writer, you try to find an interesting storyline for readers. So the storyline goes from Krishna consciousness as a culture that was all but lost to history, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but Krishna consciousness was in very poor repute in India. I mean, what was represented as being Krishna consciousness was the Sahaja movement and all kinds of awkward interpretations of Radha Krishna love affairs. And so when the British first came, the colonial period was one of, you people will never have a place on the stage of the world until you give up your uncivilized habits. And of all the uncivilized habits, do you know the one that was most offensive to the Europeans? Deity worship. They couldn't stand the idea of people worshiping idols. This was, to them, the height of barbarity. You know, this is what lost tribes do, you know, worshiping statues. So it was the worst possible thing. We'll talk more about how the Hindu intelligentsia responded to that. But the thing to understand is that when Prabhupada came, he was fighting the hardest uphill battle anyone could possibly fight. The image of the culture that he was representing was trashed, totally trashed. And he was fighting, he was promoting, he said, as soon as I tell them what the four regulative principles are, they're going to say, please go home. He said, well, let me try anyway. So there was actually a second incorporation. I'm not sure whether you're aware of that. 2 years later in Los Angeles, Prabhupada registered ISKCON as a religious society. So the incorporation that we are celebrating this year is the incorporation of ISKCON as a legal entity. 2 years later, Srila Prabhupada incorporated ISKCON as a religious organization. And the story behind that is as follows. In those years, young men in particular were being drafted to be sent off to war and to be killed in Vietnam. I'm one of them. I received in London, at Bury Place, a letter from the Selective Service with my 1A draft card. 1A means that you are to report immediately to U.S. Army base for your physical inspection and shipping out to Vietnam. 1970, I guess that was 72, 71. So I went to Prabhupada in his room at Bury Place, and I said, here's this letter. What do you suggest I do? He read the letter, and he said, they can't take you. And he went to his papers, and he pulled out a Bhakti Shastri certificate. And he signed my name in it, and he signed his name. And he handed it to me. He said, make a copy of this and send it to them. And they won't take you. So I am a diplomaed Bhakti Shastri without having taken a single class. And he literally saved my life. But in those days, you could get a religious deferment if you were a student of a legitimate religious institution. So in Los Angeles, a member of the Selective Service Board went and met Srila Prabhupada and heard from him about, you know, this is nothing that I have invented. Krishna consciousness dates from ancient times. It's this very revered tradition. And these are the texts that we study and so on. And so the man said, okay, you'll hear from us. And about a week later, Srila Prabhupada received a letter. And the letter said that before we can authorize that you are an authentic religious organization, we will need the following from you. We will need a list of your credentials, where you've received your certification, your religious certification. We will need a list of your faculty, the clergy who are teaching on your behalf. We need a list of your centers, the texts, the scriptures that you study, We will need a list of the classes that you require your students to attend. We will need a list of the different degrees, the level of degrees that you offer. So, of course, there was none of that. So Prabhupada had the letter sent out to about six of his senior disciples. And together they came up with the first Krishna consciousness educational curriculum. And that began a period of intense study of Prabhupada's books. We would read every day. We would have classes every day. There were tests, exams, quizzes every week. And we started to really know Prabhupada's books. I remember even here, sitting in Bury Place, I still have shortened hamstrings from sitting so many hours in Bury Place studying and discussing Prabhupada's books. So, of course, they were very advanced in those days. That was before we were a religious institution. Of course, what's ironic about this is that Prabhupada insisted we are not a religion. But he understood that strategically, we would first have to establish that we are a religion so that we could teach people that we are not a religion. So there were these two tests there. And he wanted us to understand the philosophy. He would hold two fingers up and say, intelligence is this close to the soul. So just a little bit of history here, and then I'd like to open this up to discussion. There was no formal institution of Vaishnavism before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami. People would practice whatever their particular gotra and lineage, whatever particular guru varga their family had been receiving initiation, they would accept initiation. And people got on wonderfully. If you go to Vrindavan today, you'll see people from Pushti Marg, people from this Marg, that Marg, this ashram, that mutt, etc., all living very cooperatively together. But it wasn't until the colonial period, and in particular, not even the beginning of the colonial period, but at one point, Parliament passed an act that we have a responsibility as Christians in India to do more than just conduct business. At first, it was the East India Company conducting trade and so on. Then Parliament passed an act saying that, no, we have a responsibility to bring the light of Christianity to the Hindus. And so there was this influx of missionaries opening schools and churches. And Hindus were coming over to that, being influenced by Christian missionary propaganda, we might say, against deities and Krishna worship and so on. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj formed the Gaudiya Math in some measure modeled on the British missionary schools, that these were places for training teachers to go out and spread the gospel of Krishna consciousness. So there were morning ceremonies. And that's another thing that I learned doing the biography, is how much of our life in ISKCON is predicated on practices and guidelines that Srila Prabhupada learned in the Gaudiya Math, from the prayers we chant, the services and ceremonies that we have each day, the menu of prasadam, dress style, everything he took from his spiritual masters, Gaudiya Math. So his love for his spiritual master cannot be measured. It was so great. Okay, that's enough. Now let's just open this up. I wanted to hear from you. I haven't been here in a very long time, and I don't recognize a lot of faces here. So why don't you tell me something about yourself? What's your name? No, I'm looking at you. Sri Ram, Hare Krishna. How old are you? 19. I remember 19. You remember 19, Mandakini? That was a good year. How long have you been here? A month. Where are you visiting from? Oh, you're from Alachua. You know my son? Huh? Okay. You look a little like him, actually. Nice to meet you. Really, open up, ask questions, anything you'd like. Yeah. My favorite experience? Every experience was a favorite experience. You can't stratify that kind of joy, you know. And sometimes terror. When Prabhupada would get heavy, you would feel it. But you never felt insulted. You know, I would do silly things. I'd ask outrageous questions. And he was always very generous, you know. I remember one time in his room here, upstairs. Must have been 73 or 74. And I said, Srila Prabhupada, what should we tell people when they ask us how come our sannyasis are falling down and getting married? And then Bhagavan was there the time he fell off his cushion. He said, Yogesh! Why are you asking Srila Prabhupada? Prabhupada said, no, it's a good question. It's a good question. And he thought for a minute. And he said, well, we have some precedent, actually, in our lineage. Nityananda Mahaprabhu was first sannyasi, and then after he got married. He said, so we have some precedent. He said, but what does it matter? What does it matter? If someone is in this ashram or that ashram, as long as he's going on with his devotional service, then it doesn't matter. He was so easy about it. We may be fanatical. He was not fanatical. He was the easiest person I've ever met in my life. Of course, he was very strict about standards, you know, and philosophy and all. But he had such an easy attitude. I think I told this story at Rameshwar Prabhu's house yesterday that one of the first devotees I met here, well, in London in 1969, later was initiated as Chiradakshayi Vishnu Prabhu. He became the first president of the Vrindavan Temple. But back in those days, I forgot what his family name was, and he had a grocery store. And he sold meat in the store. So devotees asked Prabhupada, should we ask him to stop selling? Prabhupada said, no, just encourage him. It'll happen naturally. And he became president of the Vrindavan Temple. So maybe we get a little, you know, strident. But Prabhupada was always very, you know, it's all right. So every memory is a wonderful memory. Yeah. Yes? I see a hand over here. I would change the way I explained to my family my involvement in Krishna consciousness. I didn't handle that very well. My mother didn't even know that I'd left college till I was living in Bury Place Temple. And I called her to tell her that I was getting married. What? You know. So she flew over, and my mom's a very smart woman. She's 90 now, and still handles me very well. She said, "Well, you know, you're a grown person. You're not hurting anyone by what you're doing. You're entitled to make up your own mind about what you'd like to do." And then she promptly went out to the pub on the corner and got drunk. So I think I might have handled that a little more tactfully. You know, I mean, it's scary for people. You know, You can lose your family and friends quite easily by becoming a devotee. I mean, if you're not careful about it, it's frightening. People look at this, all of a sudden you're painting your face, you know, and doing weird things with your hair and putting on bed sheets and, you know. It's frightening, you know. So be gentle and understanding with family and friends. You know, they don't necessarily understand what we're all about, and it'll frighten them. You know, it's like, what happened to Joshua? You know. Yeah. So I would probably change that. Otherwise, I wouldn't change a thing. Yeah. Spectacular. Absolutely spectacular. Every moment. What a blessing Krishna consciousness is. The good, the bad, all of it. All of it. Don't allow... All right, this is, you know, big brother Yogeshwara here. Don't allow the sad moments to overshadow your Krishna conscious life. And everyone has sad moments, and you can plug in your own definition of what that looks like. We don't know that a sad moment really is sad, even. You know, it may be unfortunate, but it, for all we know, it's the prelude to something spectacular. You know that story of the two farmers, the poor farmer and the wealthy farmer? If you don't know that story, raise your hand. Okay. So there's a wealthy farmer who's very envious of his neighbor, who's a poor farmer. And the poor farmer has only one horse in his stable. So one day this horse breaks out of the stable and runs away, and the wealthy, envious farmer comes over and says, "Oh, I guess it was bad luck, eh? Your horse ran away." And the poor, devoted farmer says, "Well, bad luck, good luck, who knows?" The next day, his horse comes down from the mountains with a wild mare that he's mated with. And now the rich farmer says, "Well, I guess it was good luck. Now you got two horses." And the poor farmer says, "Well, good luck, bad luck, who knows?" The next day, the poor farmer's son breaks his leg trying to tame the mare. So the envious farmer comes over and says, "Ha-ha, it was bad luck. Your son broke his leg." And the pious farmer says, "Well, bad luck, good luck, who knows?" The next day, the country goes to war, and all the young men are sent off to be killed, except the son of the poor farmer, because he has a broke... Anyway, it goes on and on, as you like that. So we can't judge things. Something that may seem spectacular, some wonderful big achievement, can be the entry point into something disastrous. The next day, you'd never anticipate it, some change of fortunes. Or something that looks and feels like a failure can be preparation for something absolutely marvelous, the next brilliant chapter in your Krishna conscious life. Here's something fascinating about Krishna consciousness. Spiritual progress very often masquerades as material failure. Materially, it may look like a total disaster. Spiritually, it can be absolutely the most exciting, wonderful thing that's ever happened. So don't judge by appearances. That's the first lesson of Bhagavad Gita. That's chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. Don't judge by appearances. What you see is just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more going on beneath the surface. Right?